POV, you are the leader of Russia. At the time you first came to power, Russia was starting to democratize, but you've steadfastly stood in the way of reforms. You violently crushed protests against you, and by now, all your opponents at home are either dead or in prison. Your power over Russia is unquestioned. At this point, though, you're struggling. Your dreams of expanding the vast Russian Empire, mostly to distract the populace from Russia's declining economic conditions, have made you a lot of enemies, and now you've stumbled into war. Your opponent is seen as a minor player on the world stage, a long way from being the superpower that Russia is. And in the early days of the war, there were a lot of expectations that Russia could be over and done with the whole thing before long. But that sure isn't shaping up to be the case. Every weapon in the Russian arsenal and every last man in the Russian military are forced into battle, and yet the other side keeps fighting, with unexpected aid from the world's dominant superpower of the time. Your enemy takes more Russian territory every day, and as your armies sustain huge losses, it becomes increasingly clear that Russia is losing. Even once it becomes clear you have no real path to victory, you reject offers of peace treaties, preferring Russia to keep fighting to the bitter end rather than let themselves be embarrassed. With almost no equipment left to fight with, and Russia's economy crippled by international sanctions, you decide to undertake a last-ditch effort to prop up Russia's power, one that everyone on the global stage thinks is completely insane. The year is 1904, you are Tsar Nicholas II, and your opponent is Japan. The Russo-Japanese War was a turning point in world history that I don't think gets talked about enough. When Japan won against Russia, it set the stage for both the Pacific Theater of World War II and the Russian Revolution. Japan was suddenly seen as a great power deserving respect from the West, which later emboldened it to conquer most of East Asia. We all know how that went. At the same time, Russians felt humiliated, and the opposition to the Tsar became better organized. The first attempt at a bona fide revolution in Russia happened while the war was still going on. The entire 20th century would have been unimaginably different if Russia had beaten Japan. One way the Russo-Japanese War doesn't compare too well to the present Ukrainian War is that it wasn't clearly one side's fault. It wasn't a brazen invasion of Japan on Russia's part. Russia and Japan were each fighting for their colonial interests in what's now northern China. Both of them wanted access to the strategic port city of Dalian, China, called Ryojun by the Japanese and Port Arthur by the Russians. Dalian was under Russian control at the start of the war, and it was the Japanese who fired the first shots, taking the Russians by surprise in February 1904. Many in the West, and some in Japan, saw the attack as a blunder. Among the crowned heads of Europe, there was a notion that the Japanese were racially inferior and couldn't possibly hold their own against a white nation, and even people who were more rational about the whole thing saw Russia as the clear favorite. For a lot of reasons, though, they weren't. For one thing, the fighting happened way closer to Japan than it did to most of Russia. Getting troops out to China was a huge logistical challenge for Russia, whereas Japan could just put some conscripts in a boat. Russia was too cocky about its chances, too. Everybody in the Russian aristocracy was certain that Japan just couldn't possibly win, and there was no use in making detailed plans. And if that wasn't enough, Japan was going through an intensely nationalistic period, where both the elites and the public were obsessed with the idea of rivaling Western powers and building a colonial empire. Russia, meanwhile, was on the brink of revolution. The average Russian hated the Tsar, and would rather have died fighting him than fighting for him. There were mass desertions and mutinies in the Russian forces. Before 1904 was over, nearly every ship in the Russian Navy's Pacific Fleet had been destroyed. The Japanese mines at sea, among other things, had been too successful, and Britain, which was afraid of an expansion of Russian power, had been giving the Japanese intelligence help. Russia's allies were pressing Tsar Nicholas to accept a peace treaty, but he was convinced victory was right around the corner. Possibly because his aides had been feeding him creatively edited information. He announced a plan to turn the tide of the war in Russia's favor, headed up by the decorated Rear Admiral Zinovy Rojestvensky. Russia, being a large country with coastlines on multiple fronts, effectively had three separate navies. They still do. There's the Pacific Fleet, based in Russia's Far East for defending Russia's interests in East Asia. This was the one that had been almost entirely wiped out by the Japanese. There's the Black Sea Fleet defending Russia's southeast. This is the one that's fighting in the Ukrainian war right now. In 1905, the Black Sea Fleet couldn't join the war against Japan because shipping them out to the Pacific would require them to sail through the Bosphorus Strait in Ottoman Turkey. And at the time, Turkey was no friend of Russia. That left Rozhestvensky to activate the third fleet, the one the furthest away from the scene of the action, Russia's Baltic Fleet. The Baltic Sea is a long, snaky inlet of the Atlantic between Scandinavia and the rest of Europe, with St. Petersburg, which was then the capital of Russia, at its far end. Sailing the Baltic Fleet all the way from St. Petersburg to eastern Russia would require a journey longer than the circumference of the Earth. They'd have to navigate in a lumpy sea shape around continental Europe, going through the English Channel and the Straits of Gibraltar, then to the Suez Canal. Wait, no, not the Suez Canal. Like so many things in those days, that was under the control of the British, and the British were on Japan's side. Rozhestvensky decided that he could get away with sending a few important ships via the Suez, but he wasn't going to risk the Brits cutting off the entire 38-ship fleet's access to the canal. So he added another 10,000 miles to the planned route. Now they were going to go around Africa, stopping to refuel in Madagascar, crossing the vast Indian Ocean, squeezing through the Straits of Malacca past Singapore, and finally going up between Taiwan and the Philippines to join up with the remaining Russian forces in the Pacific. If there were any Russian forces left in the Pacific by that point. It sounded crazy, but it was about to get a lot crazier. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. The Russian Baltic Fleet, hastily rebranded as the 2nd Pacific Squadron, sailed from Kronstadt near St. Petersburg on October 15, 1904, months after they'd initially planned to leave. A mighty and powerful navy this was not. The ships of the Baltic Fleet were the dregs of the Russian forces. Some of the ships had been obtained secondhand, which is a pretty remarkable thing for the navy of a major military power, and had started their lives as cargo ships or even as yachts for the Russian royals that now had guns clumsily welded on. The crew of the 2nd Pacific Squadron was mostly composed of untrained new conscripts, and on the day of departure, two ships ran aground and another two collided, piercing a hole through the hull of one of them amid the traffic jam of ships heading out for the harbor. This was nothing but an amuse-bouche for the chaos to come. As the rooftops of St. Petersburg were still fading into the distance, a deep paranoia set in among the crew. Even here, in waters mostly under Russian control, every distant ship smoke on the horizon, every fisherman's skiff, every whale spouting, every cloud casting a dark shadow over the water came to resemble a Japanese ship here to blow them to smithereens. In Admiral Rozhestvensky's eyes, the crew had good reason to be scared. After all, not long before, a Russian spy named Mikhail Herting had returned from a reconnaissance mission to Norway with chilling news. Japanese vessels were operating in the Baltic, he said, disguised as British fishing boats. Only after the war was it discovered that Herting completely made this story up, afraid that he wouldn't be paid as well if he came back from Norway with nothing to show for it. As the fleet sailed between Denmark and Sweden, St. Petersburg radioed the Danes, telling them to let Rozhestvensky know that he was being promoted from Rear Admiral to Vice Admiral. The Danish sent out a few fishermen to meet with Rogersvensky's fleet and give him the good news. Of course, upon seeing their boat, Rogersvensky opened fire. Fortunately, there were no injuries. Every last shot missed the Danish boat. Now, Rogersvensky was starting to believe this whole thing had been a bad idea, but they'd almost gotten out to the end of the Baltic Sea. Pretty soon they were going to be in the Atlantic, and there was no way they were turning back at that point. So they forged on, Rogersvensky periodically getting so mad that he would scan the horizon for Japanese ships with a pair of binoculars, then fling the binoculars overboard. This was such a well-known tick he had that his crew made sure to keep the fleet supplied with lots and lots of binoculars. A week after the fleet's departure from St. Petersburg, they were steaming through the North Sea, in between Britain and the Netherlands, in the middle of the night. Off in the distance, they saw a fleet of, you guessed it, British fishing boats. What did they do? Certain that these were actually Japanese torpedo boats, the Russians fired on them. For 20 minutes, with dozens of gunners on dozens of ships, and they missed most of them. After misidentifying the British trawlers as Japanese torpedo boats, two other large, mysterious ships began to approach the trawlers. Now these were definitely warships, the crew of the Baltic Fleet thought, even if the other ones weren't. And they were right! The problem was, they were Russian warships! Russian Baltic Fleet warships! They didn't recognize the other ships of their own fleet! Even though the fishing boats obviously had no weapons, this little battle saw as many Russian casualties as British casualties, purely because of friendly fire. The Russian ships being fired on began to report that they were being shelled by the Japanese, of course, further intensifying the chaos. Russian sailors lay down on the decks in their life vests, believing their ships were going down. Finally, after the shelling had gone on for enough time to watch an average Arrested Development episode, Rogersvensky correctly identified their enemies as actual British fishing boats just out doing some fishing, and ordered everyone to stop firing. He had known this for quite a while, but couldn't seem to convince his crew to hold their fire. Now, this was, in the words of Joe Biden, a big fucking deal. He wasn't talking about the Russian attacks on the British fishing fleet when he said that, but he could have been. Britain had already been helping Japan in the war, while remaining officially neutral, but this galvanized the UK further against Russia. In Parliament, there were murmurings of officially joining the war. Russia panicked. If they were already losing to a minor power like Japan, Britain would wipe the floor with them. A squadron of British battleships was scrambled together to effectively chase Rogersvensky's fleet out of British waters, down to Vigo, Spain, where they forced Rogersvensky to dock and hand over the officers who he deemed responsible for the incident. The officers were eventually put on trial by an international commission in neutral France, and forced to pay reparations to the families of the three British fishermen who died in the incident. On Rogersvensky's part, he was probably throwing binoculars in relief at having gotten out of that situation without starting a war or being held personally responsible. The Russians' next stop was Tangier, Morocco, under French control, where they took on coal. Between Vigo and Tangier, Rogersvensky lost track of the whereabouts of the battleship Kamchatka for several days, the same ship that had started the fishing fleet confrontation. When the Kamchatka finally rejoined them, off the coast of Morocco, the sailors on board told a harrowing story of their days-long battle with three Japanese warships. The ships they had actually engaged were a Swedish cargo ship, a German fishing trawler, and a French sailboat. Now there wasn't a major European country Russia hadn't pissed off. Fortunately, of the 300 shells the Kamchatka fired at these boats, not one of them had been a hit. The Baltic Fleet wasn't allowed to dock in Tangier, as Tangier was a neutral port. If France had allowed them to dock and take on coal, it would have been seen as an act of support for Russia, and the French really didn't want to go there. They were, however, allowed to put down their anchors just offshore from Tangier, where the ship's coal supplies were replenished by ships sent there from Germany, a sorta ally of Russia at the time. The crew of the Baltic Fleet, most of whom were on their first voyage, weren't used to much, but they especially weren't used to taking on coal at sea instead of on land. As they pulled up their anchors to continue south from Tangier, they severed the main telegraph cable connecting Tangier to Europe, cutting off communication between Morocco and France for days. France was beginning to reconsider this whole neutrality thing. With few places where they could put down an anchor and transfer coal over from the German ships, the Russian ships began carrying massive piles of coal on their decks. As the fleet sailed further south into the tropics, the coal crumbled in the humidity, releasing clouds of coal dust over the fleet, which caused nearly all the sailors to come down with respiratory issues. Before long, the Russian Baltic fleet crossed the equator, which is something I doubt anyone ever really expected the Russian Baltic fleet to do. The restless sailors, eager for something, anything to happen, threw a huge party to celebrate reaching the southern hemisphere, painting Russian flags on their bare chests and setting up a dunk tank on the deck that every officer had to take a dip in. After that, it was back to their typical day-to-day misery. Sickness was rampant, and being Russian, the crew was completely unequipped to handle the hot weather. At one point, a shipment meeting up with them to resupply them with weapons turned out to actually contain winter clothes. The ships began to rust, and barnacles caked onto their motors, slowing them down. As the fleet drew closer, through the southern tip of Africa, they sailed through a rough storm, which most of the sailors welcomed as it was a break from the heat and the coal dust that had already given a few sailors deadly cases of black lung disease. The ships made it through unscathed, but when they regrouped after the storm and did a roll call to make sure all the ships were fine, instead of giving an all-clear signal, the Kamchatka transmitted the message, "Do you see any torpedo boats?" causing yet another panic amid the fleet. Fortunately, nobody else saw anything they could possibly consider a torpedo boat, and there was no friendly fire. Everyone agreed that this was just the Kamchatka being the Kamchatka. Never change. Meanwhile, in the Far East, still thousands of miles away, Port Arthur had fallen. The Japanese flag was being raised over Russia's jewel of the Pacific, the very site the war was being fought over. Russia was pushed back to around where its border is today. Towns all over northern China were coming under Japanese control, some of which hadn't even been under Russian control at the start of the war. Japan's longtime dream of conquering China was taking root. The weak, declining Qing dynasty, which Japan had already won a war against in 1891, wasn't as formidable an adversary as even the bumbling, paranoid Russians. Now Russia's only major port in the Pacific was Vladivostok, much further north and iced over for half the year. They had no year-round port for their navy, and winter was setting in. Now where was the Baltic fleet going to end up? Vladivostok, presumably, but now they would need to sail through hundreds of miles of Japanese-controlled waters to get there. And their departure from St. Petersburg had been so rushed, very few of the sailors had had any training, and I really mean any training. When they got out into the Baltic, that was the first time many of them had seen the open ocean. Admiral Rozhestvensky had been worried before, but when he got news that Port Arthur fell, this was when he became certain Russia was going to lose. But all around him, the dejected sailors of the Russian Baltic fleet, uncertain of whether they would ever see their home again, found something else to lift their spirits. Lemurs. Despite the kerfuffle with the British, a few Russian ships had managed to get through the Suez Canal, and they had planned to meet up with the main fleet near the island of Nosy Be, close to Madagascar. Once again, they weren't allowed to dock, since Madagascar was under the control of, by this point officially neutral, but unofficially super annoyed, France. But they could put down their anchors, hopefully not breaking any pesky telegraph lines this time, and take on more coal, which I'm sure was very popular among the sailors who had not yet died of black lung. From this point on, Rozhestvensky didn't know what his path forward was. He couldn't take the fleet to Port Arthur anymore, and if he tried to go to Vladivostok, he'd need to navigate Japanese waters. He ended up keeping the fleet in Madagascar for 2.5 months as he waited for orders from St. Petersburg, and it ended up being an eventful 2.5 months. The cooped-up crew stampeded off the ships and on to the island proper of Nosy Be, where they pissed off the French colonial authorities yet again by doing everything sailors on shore leave can be expected to do. But this was Madagascar, and in the eyes of the Russians, who had never been to such an exotic place, the charms of the local ladies and liquors paled in comparison to the lemurs. And snakes! and chameleons, and a crocodile, and all these other animals that very few Russians had ever seen before. The ships of the Baltic Fleet became a floating zoo. Some of the crews welcomed the introduction of snakes to the boat's ecosystem because they helped with the ever-worsening rat problem on board, until one of the snakes wound itself around a gun on one of the ships, impeding the ship's ability to aim, and bit the hand of the officer trying to remove it. It was poisonous, and the hand had to be amputated. Most of the snakes were hunted down and killed after that. The dozens of chameleons that were brought on as pets were next on the hit list, but they had already scurried off to far corners of the ships and were understandably rather difficult to find. There were probably still a few chameleons on board each ship when they all eventually met a watery grave. And yes, that's a spoiler for how this story will end, but let's be real, given how this episode has been going so far. Did you expect this ragtag band of tsarists to get to Vladivostok in one piece? After the fishing fleet incident, did you even expect them to get this far? Snakes, crocs, and chameleons weren't the only animals who had joined the crew of the Baltic Fleet in Nosy Bay. A few brown-nosing sailors presented Admiral Roger Svensky with a gift of a parrot, who soon picked up his extensive vocabulary of Russian curse words. Whether it also learned to throw binoculars is lost to history. And, as the old saying goes, being in Madagascar without catching a lemur and taking it into war with you is like being in Pisa and not taking one of those hackneyed forced perspective photos where you look like you're pushing the Leaning Tower back into place. Nearly every sailor brought a lemur or two into their cabin. Lemurs are smart, dexterous little fuckers, and pretty soon things were going missing all over the ship, including the sailors' special cigarettes. Because, oh yeah, that was another thing they acquired on shore in Nosy Bay. Crates and crates of opium-laced cigarettes. Given the conditions, I mean, can you blame them? But from Roger Svensky's perspective, this one weird trick his sailors had discovered to boost morale was not it. His crew was useless enough already. Worse still, news came over the wire of another massive Russian defeat. Russian forces, retreating across northern China, had been set upon by 270,000 Japanese troops outside the city of Mukden, now known as Shenyang. Japan had gotten impatient and now wanted to destroy the Russian army, not just force them off their land. By the sheer number of troops, it was the largest battle ever fought by that point. Today, only a few engagements of World Wars I and II and the Chinese Civil War have surpassed it, and it was a resounding victory for the Japanese. The Russian army had no realistic chance of holding on to any territory in China anymore. Russia had fallen for the oldest trick in the book: never get involved in a land war in Asia. Only their naval power was left, and their naval power was hanging out in Madagascar, getting addicted to narcotics. Roger Svensky considered giving the whole voyage the same treatment he regularly gave his binoculars. If he had turned the fleet around and chugged right back to the Baltic and Russia had run up the white flag right around then, the Tsar could have saved face. He'd still have half a navy. Russia's national humiliation would be forgotten after a few years. Other global powers would see them as having done the difficult thing by making the right choice. But no. Roger Svensky telegraphed St. Petersburg, announcing that he was resigning from the Navy. The Tsar rejected it and ordered him to forge on. Russia's greatest weakness was not the hubris of the Tsar, nor the sheer head-empty unpreparedness of their troops. It was the sunk cost fallacy. They'd gotten their Baltic fleet all the way down to Madagascar, about as far from the Baltic as you can possibly get. They were going to finish the journey, goddammit. Even if it meant that their costs would end up being sunk in a much more literal way. So, finally, the Russian Baltic Fleet gathered up their straggling crew and made preparations to leave Nosy Bay. The departure process was messy. The sailors had been enjoying themselves for the first time in months. A few threatened to mutiny if they left. A few more literally went insane. An officer paraded up and down the deck of one of the ships dressed in an Orthodox priest's robe, asking his crewmates if they feared death. The worst of the bunch were rounded up and sent back to Russia on a ship called the Malay. As soon as the Malay left Nosy Be, predictably, it was taken over by mutineers. Order was eventually restored, and the mutineers were permanently marooned on Nosy Be, which was what they had wanted in the first place, so crime really does pay. Rogosvensky figured it was high time to get his crew into shape. Remember, they hadn't had a single day of training before leaving St. Petersburg. Maybe this was for the better, because they'd been doing everything short of misidentifying seagulls as Japanese torpedo boats, and if they'd had better aim, there would have been a lot more international incidents. But now, the fleet was on the last leg of its journey. Pretty soon, they really would be at risk of running into Japanese torpedo boats, and they had to be ready. Rogosvensky got one of the working ships to tow a derelict member of the fleet, which they would be leaving behind in Madagascar, behind it on a chain, for the sailors to do target practice on. They scored one single hit. It was on the ship doing the towing. Sickness continued taking sailors. Now, in addition to respiratory diseases, there were STIs added to the mix, as well as food poisoning after the freezer on one of the ships containing most of the troops' meat failed in the heat. The rotten meat was thrown overboard, attracting, of course, an entourage of sharks. Rogosvensky's chief of staff became paralyzed following a brain hemorrhage. A huge funeral was held for the sailors they lost along the way, during which someone had the not-so-bright idea of tasking the Kamchatka with firing a salute. They didn't know that they were supposed to load the guns with blanks, and they struck another ship called the Aurora, one of the same ships that had been fired on during the fishing fleet incident. Rogosvensky ordered the ships to do another training exercise before leaving Nosy Be. 7 battleships were supposed to sail in formation, then each fire a torpedo. They couldn't even sail straight, forming a sort of anarchic mess in the water and then firing torpedoes at each other. The crew of the Kamchatka announced that they had been struck and were sinking, at which celebration broke out on the other ships upon hearing the news. The long-suffering engineer for the fleet, Yevgeny Politovsky, went down to the Kamchatka's engine room to see what the matter was. Much to everyone's disappointment, a single steam pipe was leaking. The Kamchatka was in no danger of sinking. On March 16, 1905, after 2.5 months of chaos in Madagascar, and 2.5 months of chaos before that on the high seas, the Russian Baltic fleet steamed away from Nosy Be and set off across the Indian Ocean. Now they were in open ocean, thousands of miles from any land. There was no turning back. Boredom was pushed away by organizing rat hunts. Every now and then, chameleons kept turning up. Rogosvensky's journals reported that the man jumped to his death from one of the ships at one point, and the way Rogosvensky casually tosses that off implies that it wasn't an uncommon occurrence at this stage in the journey. The question from that one deranged officer back in Nosy Be stuck in the mind of every sailor. Did they fear death? There wasn't much of a chance that anything else was awaiting the Baltic fleet once they reached their destination. For all intents and purposes, Russia had already lost to Japan, and now they were sending their remaining ships in their navy and thousands of troops to be needlessly destroyed. They were sailing to their doom, and everybody, except maybe the Tsar, knew that. The ships took on coal while passing through the Straits of Malacca near Singapore. Now they had gone from the Indian Ocean to the Pacific, the first time the officially designated 2nd Pacific Squadron reached the ocean it was named for. In late May, the German coal-carrying ships that had been shadowing the Baltic Fleet for their whole journey docked in Shanghai. While the Japanese intelligence services were a lot less powerful than the Russians feared they were and didn't quite know when the Baltic Fleet would reach their waters, they were now able to estimate right about where the fleet was. They knew Rogosvensky had to be heading toward Vladivostok. If the coal ships were ending their journey in Shanghai, clearly the Baltic fleet was going to try to get from there to Vladivostok on one tank of gas, as it were. They could have swung out into the open Pacific and gone around the outside of Japan to get to Vladivostok, avoiding Japanese territorial waters between Japan and Korea. But that was a longer trip, and would have required them to take on coal at sea one last time. So clearly, they weren't taking that route. Japan's Admiral Heihachiro Togo gathered his naval fleet at the narrowest choke point in between Shanghai and Vladivostok, at the Tsushima Straits, between Japan and Japanese-occupied Korea. The trap was set. In a few days, he knew, the Baltic Fleet would need to sail through that area. And so, at long last, after traveling 19,000 miles through every kind of weather, picking fights with every major power on the way, and racking up a barely believable tally of fuck-ups, getting their ships crusted with layers of barnacles and mussels on the outside, and full of rats and well-hidden chameleons on the inside, after 7 months of assuming every passing fishing boat and cargo vessel and weird noise at night and everything else to be a Japanese warship, in the wee hours of May 27th, 1905, moving without lights on, the Russian Baltic Fleet finally encountered an honest-to-goodness Japanese torpedo boat. Someway, somehow, they thought they were closer to Vladivostok than they were, and that the ship they were encountering had to be Russian. So, the brave sailors of the battleship Oriol immediately broadcast a radio message to the Japanese ship, informing them of how many ships were in the Baltic Fleet, what condition they were in, how many troops they had, and how they planned to attack. So began the Battle of Tsushima, sometimes called the Last Great Naval Battle. 125 Japanese vessels engaged 38 Russian vessels. The Russians would have been underdogs even if they had the best men and the best ships, and they didn't. As it was a curb stomp. 28 Russian ships went right to the bottom, along with 5,000 Russian sailors. Most of the rest were captured. Roger Svensky himself sustained a head injury from shrapnel and was taken to a hospital in Kyushu after the battle by the magnanimous Japanese, where Admiral Togo personally visited him to console him that there was nothing dishonorable about losing a fair fight. Roger Svensky probably felt differently, though, as when he returned to Russia, he accepted full responsibility for the catastrophe of the Baltic Fleet and was sentenced to death as sort of a scapegoat for the humiliated Russian people. The Tsar commuted his sentence and let him go free, which was probably the right choice. Of all the thousands of people on board the Baltic Fleet, Roger Svensky may have been the least culpable. He was a competent admiral forced to herd a lot of cats. Sure, he was quick to anger. Somewhere on the bottom of three of Earth's oceans, from St. Petersburg to Tsushima via Madagascar, there are dozens of century-old pairs of binoculars, covered in silt where he flung them off his ship. But plenty of military leaders are mercurial. Roger Svensky was the right admiral put in charge of the wrong ships, the wrong sailors, the wrong itinerary, and the wrong plan in the first place, all in the service of the wrong Tsar. As I've said before, Russia could have spun an early surrender into a victory. Losing Port Arthur was definitely a better outcome than losing the confidence of the people. But once they'd been fighting for a few months, they were determined to finish what they started, whether that meant a bruised and battered victory or a catastrophic defeat. One of my favorite quotes to use as a snow clone is a line attributed to Huey P. Long, the infamous governor/dictator of Louisiana in the 1930s, who allegedly said, "If I can't be the best governor Louisiana ever had, I'll settle for being the worst." This was the Tsar's mentality. If it can't be a resounding victory, it'll have to be a resounding defeat. Nothing else is glorious. The shadow of the Russo-Japanese War looms large in world history. Russians were shocked by how much of a disaster the war turned out to be. They had gotten used to winning wars against rival powers. They had a national reputation as the country that foils every power-hungry conqueror's plans. Some historians place the dawn of Russia's status as a superpower in 1709, when they successfully crushed an invasion by Sweden. Napoleon famously failed spectacularly in his invasion of Russia, sustaining the biggest military losses in history up to that point. Now, Russia had gotten a taste of its own medicine. Not only had they lost a war, they lost it in exactly the way so many rival nations had lost to Russia. This time, the country, ruined by its own vanity and the vastness of Russia, was Russia itself. While the war was still underway, and Roger Svensky and co. were sailing across the Indian Ocean, revolutionary unrest had broken out across Russia. The Tsar introduced a few minor democratic reforms, but it was seen as too little too late. 12 years later, with the Russian economy still in shambles from the war and Russian pride still bruised, the second real attempt at a revolution succeeded, establishing the Soviet Union as we know it today. God only knows what would have happened in world history if the Tsarist government had managed to hold on to popularity by ending the war early. And Japan began to gain respect as a great power. If they could beat Russia, they thought, who couldn't they beat? Japanese imperialism was on the rise even before the war, but winning at Tsushima turbocharged it. If you need any other indication that Japan's World War II-era expansionism was fueled by their victory against the Russians, consider this. The naval flag flown at the Pearl Harbor attack was the exact same flag, not a copy of the same flag, the flag that Admiral Togo had flown at Tsushima. The entire Pacific theater of World War II would have been different if the Russo-Japanese War hadn't ended the way it did, and that would have butterflied out into a nearly unrecognizable world order. Think, how was your family involved in World War II? Maybe your future grandparents or great-grandparents met during the war. Or maybe the Cold War shaped your family tree in some way. Maybe you have relatives who were in Vietnam, something that definitely wouldn't have happened without the USSR and America's fear of it. All these years later, the insane voyage of the Russian Baltic Fleet sounds like an entertaining historical footnote, but it's possible that you, and everyone you know, owes their existence as they are to the time a bunch of Russian warships went and fucked themselves.
Break your bones. What puts you on your knees?